Okay, don't skip ahead. I'm going to talk to you about climate change. And I know it can get depressing or infuriating, but our show takes a different approach. It's Laura Lynch, and I'm the host of What on Earth, and we're all about solutions and hope. And I promise, no matter how overwhelming climate change might feel, we're with you on the journey to fix this mess. So listen now, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
It can be done. It has been done before, but a lot of factors come into play. But at this point, it's this animal's best chance.
The tale of a whale. Herculean efforts on the BC coast to return a baby orca to its pod. It's been orphaned and trapped in a lagoon for several weeks. Welcome to Your World Tonight. It's just before 6 Eastern Time on Friday, April 12th. I'm Tom Harrington. Also on the podcast.
We are devoted to the defense of Israel. We will support Israel. We will help defend Israel. And Iran will not succeed.
Joe Biden's warning to Tehran. As the prospect grows, Iran is set to retaliate for the apparent Israeli strike that killed some top generals. U.S. military bases are on high alert. Travel warnings have been issued. And diplomatic channels are busy. We're following other stories, too, including a new study that debunks a medical myth about the COVID vaccine. We begin in a tiny lagoon in a remote coastal community in British Columbia. After weeks of planning, crews, a crane, and a giant sling swung into action early today to rescue an orphan baby orca. But the operation has now stopped. The CBC's Tanya Fletcher is on the story. Tanya, what can you tell us about why they stopped?
Well, Tom, we're just getting this information in now. The Department of Fisheries and Oceans has just put out a statement saying at 12:45 p.m. Pacific, the DFO and the Hadasat First Nation made the decision to stand down the operation, suspending it for now, because she's simply not ready to be moved, this two-year-old orca. They say there were a number of methods employed this morning to coax her into the shallow end of the lagoon, and at each coordinated maneuver, she evaded and returned to the area that she's been hanging out in. So for now, they are calling off this plan. Of course, this rescue operation began early this morning. The First Nation says they're teams assembled at 5 a.m. and they've been taking the lead with the feds on this. But in the meantime, they blocked off access to the area, to the public and to the media. So it's been a challenge getting information and updates out until now.
It was a very complicated operation. What was the plan going in to get the whale out?
Yeah, well, keep in mind, they've been planning this for almost 3 weeks now. They've considered a number of scenarios, including at one point possibly airlifting the young orca by helicopter. But now all hopes have been hinging on a massive sling. That's this latest plan. They've been rehearsing and doing dry runs up until today. The idea was to corral the young orca into the sling. Sounds like that's where they ran into the trouble this morning. That sling was then going to be used and lifted by crane onto the shore. That's where an industrial-sized flatbed truck with rails had been waiting. And then it's unclear where the orca would be taken from there, but there was consideration of then moving her by boat, possibly into open water, where then she'd hopefully reunite with the rest of her pod.
That's awfully complicated, a lot of challenges. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, what were the upsets after that?
Yes, so many logistical hurdles at play. I mean, that's why the timeline has been so uncertain. They didn't know when they'd proceed with this operation until it was happening. So many variables needed to be in place. You know, they had to look at the right weather, the tides, all of those things had to align. And consider the location alone. You know, this is a remote community off the west coast of northern Vancouver Island. So even getting the resources to this site was a challenge. And remember, you know, crews have been spending weeks also just trying to coax the calf out on its own. But those attempts were unsuccessful. We did speak today with Tomas Daniel Valcroze with the DFO. He's not on site himself, but a member of his team is. And he says this current plan certainly wasn't the preferred one, but more of a last resort.
It can be done. It has been done before, but a lot of factors come into play. The terrain, like the local topography of the place, the behavior of the animal. It's something that we wish we didn't have to do because it's obviously very stressful for the animal and it can be dangerous. But at this point, it's this animal's best chance. It's still a very hazardous operation.
So, Tanya, do we know what happens next?
Well, we know the team will regroup this afternoon to start work of planning the next steps, but it's unclear when the next operation attempt or rescue attempt might proceed, whether that's tomorrow perhaps, or whether it'll take a few days, whether they'll even stick with that same plan or move to a different scenario. All of these things we don't know. It's a very fluid situation, but we'll keep you updated with the latest as we get it.
Thanks for this.
You bet.
The CBC's Tanya Fletcher in Vancouver. After weeks of announcements, the Liberal government unveiled its plan to solve the nation's housing crisis. The multi-billion dollar collection of programs and incentives is targeted at making both renting and purchasing homes easier, particularly for Millennial and Gen Z Canadians. Evan Dyer has the details.
Today, we are releasing the most comprehensive and ambitious housing plan ever seen in Canada.
Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has been rolling out parts of the budget for a couple of weeks now. Today's was a big one.
It's a plan to build housing, including for renters, on a scale not seen in generations. We're talking about almost 3.9 million homes by 2031.
That is a huge amount of new housing to promise, but the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation says about that much is needed to restore affordability. The plan involves the federal government opening up its own lands to builders. Housing Minister Sean Fraser.
We're also going to be launching new measures that help unlock federal lands in a way that we have never pursued before, including with a new strategy that will allow us to maintain ownership of the land and enter into long-term leases so we can reduce the cost not just of construction, but the cost of living for the people who were living the homes built on those lands.
For people who've been around this space for a very long time, it's sort of hard to get excited because you hear an announcement and you think, well, I heard this 10 years ago.
But developer Jennifer Kiesmet, former chief city planner for Toronto, says this announcement is different.
We're seeing language and a scale of an initiative that I've never seen before.
In the past, the government would usually sell its lands for development. That means home buyers have to pay the full cost of the land their home sits on. Now the federal government is proposing to lease the land for a period like 99 years. It's the way many houses are sold in Britain, and it's also common in BC. There are also new incentives to make projects that currently don't add up more profitable.
And there's lots of those. Developments that are already, they have their municipal approvals, but the developer is not proceeding to construction because the cost of borrowing makes it prohibitive.
The budget will increase what's called the capital cost allowance, which allows a builder to deduct from their taxes the losses they take as assets depreciate, assets such as rental buildings, appliances, and furniture. The government proposes to more than double the rate at which builders can claim those losses back. Economist Mike Moffat.
I think this, you know, this is a policy that worked back in the 1960s, and I think it will work again today.
Even with the new incentives to build, there aren't enough construction workers to do the building, and the budget proposes to train more through new apprenticeship programs and faster approval of foreign trades credentials. Experts say the measures have the potential to spur a significant amount of new building. They're going to have to if they're to close a housing gap that till now has continued to get wider. Evan Dyer, CBC News, Ottawa.
Another Trudeau government policy, the carbon tax, has been under relentless attack from the Conservatives. Now that's caught Jagmeet Singh in the crossfire. The federal NDP leader is seeing some of his supporters swayed by the constant axe the tax sloganeering. And that's prompted Singh to suggest he'll start pushing the Liberals to reduce the impact on consumers. Marina von Stackelberg has more from Ottawa.
We want to lay out our vision, a new Democrat vision for how we tackle the climate crisis.
That vision for NDP leader Jagmeet Singh is not so clear. He was asked yesterday if he still supports the increasingly unpopular carbon tax on consumers.
We don't have our full plan laid out, but we have some elements, the principles of our plan. And the principles I wanted to lay out today were that I find it problematic that the Liberals have set up a divisive system where they're dividing the country.
Singh says the NDP supports the carbon tax on corporations and big polluters, but says taxing people on gas and electricity is not fair.
It should not be that a working class person has to make that choice, that am I on climate fighting side or am I on affordability side?
Singh's urge to appeal to working class Canadians, traditionally the bread and butter of NDP support, might have something to do with this man.
Who's ready to axe the tax?
Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre. A poll out this week shows that his Conservative Party has its largest lead yet, some of it at the expense of the NDP. It comes as several New Democrat MPs have announced they won't run in the next election. Maybe seeing the writing on the wall, says David Coletto, CEO of Abacus Data.
Those are ridings that I know the Conservatives are targeting, and the kind of voters that they're attracting are the ones that live in those kind of, you know, rural, sort of outside the big city kind of ridings in Northern Ontario, interior BC, and so on.
Abacus's latest poll shows the NDP has slipped 2 percentage points in the last 2 weeks, down to 17%. Coletto says the deal between the New Democrats and Liberals has led to policy wins like dental and pharmacare, but that hasn't made them more popular with voters.
The New Democrats really are struggling to differentiate themselves from the Liberals.
I don't know.
Prime Minister Justin Trudeau shrugged off Singh's change in tone.
I understand the political pressures on the NDP leadership right now and the challenges of holding an unpopular position. But doing the right thing should be something that progressive voters in this country can count on.
But some of those progressive voters say the NDP has lost its way in fighting climate change by signing the deal to support the Liberal minority government.
I was very disappointed.
One of them is Senior Ken Johnson.
They didn't maintain their ability to lobby on climate, or that climate wasn't part of the deal. Finally, after so many years, they got the balance of power, and then in my humble estimation, they sort of gave it away.
After Singh's comments yesterday, today the NDP released a statement saying the party has not changed its stance on the need for a carbon tax. Marina von Stackelberg, CBC News, Ottawa.
Coming right up on the podcast, speculation is high that Iran is about to strike in retaliation for an attack that killed some of the country's top generals. Plus, recall to compare what he recalls. The head of Canada's spy agency returned to testify on foreign interference 24 hours after the Prime Minister's testimony about what he was told and wasn't told by CSIS. We'll also tell you about a new study which debunks a popular conspiracy theory about the mRNA vaccine used to fight COVID. Travel alerts, military movements, blunt diplomatic language. All of it suggesting Iran is about to strike back for the alleged Israeli missile attack that killed some top Iranian generals. And if that happens, could it lead to a wider war? Senior international correspondent Margaret Evans has the latest.
In Gaza, the daily fight to survive grinds on. The fervent wish of so many Gazans now facing starvation in addition to months of bombardment and of Israeli relatives of hostages held by Hamas is for a ceasefire. But warnings from Washington of what it calls a credible threat that Iran is planning an imminent attack against Israel have raised fears of escalation. This was the U.S. President Joe Biden asked about that threat tonight.
My expectations sooner than later.
Mr. President, to Iran in this moment?
Don't.
Washington has sent its top general to Israel in a gesture of support, meeting with Israel's defense minister. Our enemies think they can pull Israel and the United States apart, says Yoav Gallant. But the opposite is true. They're bringing us together. Israel is widely believed to have been behind an attack on the Iranian consulate in Damascus earlier this month, but reportedly didn't inform Washington ahead of time. 7 people were killed, including 2 top generals, prompting Tehran to promise retaliation.
But they fear at the end of the day, any direct clash with Israel will bring in the United States and the UK and other Western powers, and that's the Iranian leaders do not really want to take risks, strategic risks, and attack Israel directly.
Some analysts, including Fawaz Gerges, believe if there is a retaliatory attack, it could come from one of Iran's many proxies in the region. The most powerful, Hezbollah, in neighboring Lebanon, has been firing rockets at Israel in support of Hamas since October 7th. There were more tonight.
By attacking Iran's sovereignty and Iran's consulate in Damascus, Israel is either directly or indirectly expanding or trying to expand the conflict, which goes against the overarching goal of the Biden administration.
Whether there is or isn't a direct attack against Israel from Iran, the potential for things to spin out of control in the Middle East is never very far from the surface. Countries from Russia and Australia to France and Canada are advising against travel to the region. Margaret Evans, CBC News, London.
The head of Canada's spy agency was back in the hot seat today at the inquiry into foreign interference. David Vigneault had already testified, but he was called back after testimony from Justin Trudeau and members of his cabinet and staff. They all claimed key details of CSIS briefing notes never made it to them. Tom Perry has the story.
L'ordre, s'il vous plaît. Order, please.
A brief appearance to talk about briefings. CSIS Director David Vigneault back before the inquiry into foreign interference to explain a discrepancy between briefing notes prepared for him when he sat down with Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and his staff and what was actually discussed at those meetings. The inquiry has seen notes that include stark warnings about Chinese meddling in Canada's elections, but during their testimony this week, Trudeau and his inner circle said those warnings didn't come up when they met the CSIS director.
First of all, these are briefing notes that I never saw. These are briefings.
Back in the witness chair, Vigneault told the inquiry, there's nothing sinister or even surprising about the fact briefing notes and briefings don't always match.
It's not extraordinary to go to a briefing having material and having prepared yourself to discuss a topic, and it's something completely different.
Vigneault says briefing books typically contain vast amounts of information. And as for those warnings in his notes, that China had interfered in the 2019 and 2021 elections, that Canada was slow to respond, and that CSIS had reason to believe Beijing may have orchestrated an online campaign against conservative candidates in 2021, Vigneault told the inquiry he's made all those points, either in public or in private meetings with government officials.
I would not have gone through these notes because these are statements that I had made before.
Vigneault says he stands by those warnings, but also the central conclusion that while Beijing did interfere in the last two federal campaigns, it did not affect their outcome.
Madam Commissioner, would you allow me to say one thing?
Yes, you can.
The CSIS director made a point of ending his appearance with a defense of his agency after a week in which government officials, including the prime minister, questioned its work.
There's been a lot of comment made about the intelligence in the media, in the commission and so on. And I just would like to say that as a director of CSIS, I think it's important that we understand that intelligence is a little bit like a puzzle.
Vigneault's testimony wraps up this portion of the inquiry. An interim report is due early next month as Commissioner Marie-José Hug pours through the evidence and tries to piece together that puzzle. Tom Perry, CBC News, Ottawa.
It's been a month since Haiti's unpopular prime minister agreed to step down. Today, a transitional council was appointed to choose the next leader. But the gang leaders who toppled Ariel Henry have a tight grip and have plunged Haitians into deeper chaos, fear, and hunger. The widespread violence has made it almost impossible for aid and healthcare workers to help the people there. Alison Northcock spoke to some of those who haven't given up trying.
À Port-au-Prince, je dirais, c'est le traumatisme au quotidien.
Father Nestor Fils-Aimé says life in the capital, Port-au-Prince, has become a daily series of traumas. He left Haiti a few days ago. On his way back to Montreal, where his parish is based, he spoke to us from Florida. It's very risky, he says. There are daily clashes and stray bullets. When we take the risk to go out, we don't know if we'll come back. Gang violence has gripped the country amid ongoing political turmoil and a worsening humanitarian and security crisis. The United Nations says 2,500 people were killed, kidnapped, or injured in the first 2 months of the year alone. More than 300,000 have been displaced.
it's getting harder and harder each day to get those medications, get those medical supplies to the patient.
Dr. Rachel Levine from Sherbrooke, Quebec, has been working in a small hospital with Doctors Without Borders in Port-au-Prince. Some days, she says she treats up to a dozen gunshot wounds. She recalls one patient who couldn't get the life-saving care she needed because of the violence.
And then we decide to transfer to our other hospital with operating room, but then because there were so much battle outside of the hospital, we could not move our ambulance, so she died.
Some health facilities have stopped operating altogether. Violence around them forcing them to close, says Carlotta Piani-Giana with the Alliance for International Medical Action.
Some of the health facilities have been attacked directly by the armed group. Some of them, they've been, you know, looted. But there are also difficulties in the facilities that are still functioning because of lack of HR.
She says with access to most airports and the main port blocked off, life-saving supplies, including food, are running low and getting increasingly costly.
There is nobody in reality who is in charge in Haiti right now.
Montreal-based sociologist Frédéric Boiron says Haiti's Prime Minister Ariel Henry agreed to resign and hand over power to a transitional presidential council. But a month later, the gangs still dominate.
We are now into a civil war because they are fighting to take over the government of Haiti. They want to be in power.
As Father Fils-Aimé returns to Montreal, he's hoping a sense of security can be restored in Haiti soon.
La situation s'est empirée.
But even in the days since he's left, he says things have only gotten worse. Alison Northcott, CBC News, Montreal.
A French Oblate priest accused of sexually abusing children in Nunavut has died. The accusations against Johannes Rivoire go back decades to when he served the Catholic Church in the territory. Rivoire returned to France and declined to return to Canada for trial. The French government refused to extradite him, despite a request from Canada. The Oblates of Mary Immaculate say they regret Rivoire will never face the charges laid against him.
Good evening, I'm Robert McNeil in New York.
Canadian journalist Robert McNeil has died. He was born in Montreal and raised in Halifax. His career included stints with the CBC and the BBC, but he truly made his mark in the United States, where he joined Jim Lehrer to host the McNeil-Lehrer Report on PBS. The primetime partnership started in the 70s and lasted two decades. McNeil wrote books about his career in journalism and novels. He spoke to the CBC in 1992 about the appeal of writing compared to hosting the news.
The trouble with television is that the minute it's over, everybody forgets it instantly, and it just vanishes into the ether. And when you write something and somebody prints it, it remains there, and people keep referring to it. The first book I published in 1968, and while it had a fairly small appeal at the time, people come and talk to me about it now.
Yeah.
Nobody does that about television programs.
Robert McNeil died in a New York hospital today. He was 93. A new study is debunking a widespread myth about COVID vaccines. It shows there's no evidence mRNA shots cause fatal heart issues in young people. The research follows a string of unfounded theories linking vaccines to deadly cardiac arrest in athletes. Health reporter Christine Birak breaks down the data.
And now another Bills player is down.
When Buffalo Bills safety DeMar Hamlin collapsed on the football field last year, there was speculation the 25-year-old's cardiac arrest was vaccine-related.
The sports world grinding to a halt after
Hamlin has since recovered. Now the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say there's no evidence mRNA COVID vaccines cause deadly heart problems in teens and young adults.
There is no increased risk of dying.
Dr. Christopher Labos is a cardiologist and epidemiologist in Montreal.
I think it is important to have this type of definitive analysis done.
American researchers examined nearly 1,300 death certificates of Oregon residents aged 16 to 30, all of whom died from a heart condition or unknown reason over a year and a half beginning in June 2021. Researchers say nearly 1 million young people in Oregon got a COVID vaccine during that time. Three died within 100 days of being vaccinated. Two of those deaths were attributed to chronic underlying health conditions, including type 2 diabetes and respiratory failure. The third was recorded as undetermined natural cause.
Because if you have a large enough group of people, a certain number of them are going to die after they got a vaccine from other causes, or maybe they would have had a cardiovascular event regardless.
The Oregon Review also found 30 young people died from COVID-19 during that same time, most of whom were unvaccinated.
The people we want to reach with this evidence probably won't even look at it. They'll continue to believe that, well, there's a downside to vaccines.
Dr. Prabhat Jha is a professor of global health at the University of Toronto. He says groups promoting misinformation continue to seize on seemingly unexplained deaths to undermine vaccines, which is why the American Review matters.
I think we need to do more of that in Canada as well. Counter the direct claims made by the anti-vaxxers with science, and do so in a non-judgmental way, saying you have your opinions, but here are the data. Hopefully you'll change your opinions.
I'm still trying to process all the emotions.
Damar Hamlin says his dramatic collapse on the football field was the result of a rare heart condition triggered by a precise blow to his chest. He's now trying to raise awareness about the importance of CPR and heart health. Christine Burak, CBC News, Toronto.
It was a moment of delight and awe. The eclipse that swept across North America on Monday had millions gazing up to the sky in wonder.
It was like a really amazing thing to witness.
Sean DeVry of St. Thomas, Ontario relished that sense of wonder too, not only as a stargazer, but as a retailer. Her shop sold eclipse glasses before the event, but once it was over, her sense of wonder was more like, wonder what happens to all those glasses.
My business, since its inception, has tried our best to reduce, reuse, recycle, which is kind of a challenge in retail in general. There's a lot of waste in retail, but I just saw a need to, and decided to fill it.
DeVry contacted a group called Astronomers Without Borders that's collecting the funky-looking shades. If they're still usable, it will distribute them to people so they can watch future eclipses anywhere in the world. She put out a note telling her customers and anyone else they can bring them to her shop. The response eclipsed her expectations.
This blew up more than I anticipated. I thought I was going to like send a little box over to California and that would be kind of the end of it for me.
That little box will need to be a bit bigger. DeVries received more than 1,000 pairs after just 2 days collecting them. She's not the only option to recycle your eclipse glasses. Other businesses, even libraries, will take them too. Or you could just hang on to the ones you have. After all, there are partial solar eclipses coming up in Canada next year and the year after that. You want to keep your eyes out for that. This has been Your World Tonight for Friday, April 12th. I'm Tom Harrington. Thanks for listening tonight. Stay safe and take care of each other.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.